Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, the Center for the Study of Europe, and the Department of English. Our speaker is Pascal Drouet, professor of English and Early Modern Literature at the University of Poitiers, France. Professor Drouet's lecture is titled Madness in Jacobean England, the Asylum and the Playhouse. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of English, William Carroll.
As her Boston University host, I'm privileged to introduce my friend and colleague, Professor Pascal Drouet. Professor Drouet is a visiting researcher in the Department of English. Professor Drouet is full professor of English and early modern literature at the University of Poitiers, France. Her undergraduate degree is from the University of Lyon. Her PhD is from the University of Paris, Sorbonne. Prior to going to Poitiers in 2004, she taught at the University of Limoges. Professor Drouet has published translations of three plays by the English playwright Howard Barker, The Moving and the Still, 2011, I Saw Myself, 2014, and forthcoming in 2019, At Her Age and Hers. She's also translated two plays by the wonderful Scottish playwright David Greig, Dunsinane, which is, of course, a Shakespeare-linked play, 2016, and forthcoming in 2019, Outlying Islands. As if this isn't enough, she's also working on a translation into French of Philaster, or Love Lies a Bleeding, a tragicomedy written by Francis Beaumont and John Fletcher, Shakespeare's contemporaries, around 1608-1610. She's also translated, as I indicated, the poetry of Galway Connell, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, in 2017, and a volume entitled Childhood, 2017, by the American Emily Groschultz. I learned just a few days ago that Professor Drouet, as I should have deduced, writes poetry herself, and her first volume, English titled Cartographic Songs, will be published in France by late 2019 or early 2020. I first met Professor Drouet through the field of Shakespearean studies, in which she's established a major international reputation with several books. I give the titles in English translation. Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost, 2014. Cunning Practices in Early Modern England, a Study of Plays by Shakespeare and Contemporary Authors, 2013. Banishment and Abuse of Power, Shakespeare's Denial of Territory, 2012. And Vagrancy in Shakespeare's England, The Art of Counterfeiting in the City and the Playhouse, 2003. She's also been a prolific editor with an edition of Shakespeare's Henry VIII for the Norton Shakespeare, and at least five solely or co-edited volumes covering topics from banishment and exile to approaches to King Lear to the spectacular in and around Shakespeare. I can testify firsthand to her meticulous scholarship. Last year, we co-edited a volume of essays in English on John Webster's The Duchess of Malfi. She's published a host of other articles in both English and French and is currently working on a book in English, Shakespeare and the Denial of Territory, which will be published by Manchester University Press. I could go on and on and on, but I won't. Her editorship of an online Shakespeare journal, her many reviews, individual articles and conference papers, and her occasional work as a dramaturg, and even, I learned, a comic actor with a student dramatic troupe at the University of Poitiers, where she has acted the role of Feste in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. But it would be much better to hear from her directly. Her topic today, Madness in Jacobean England, The Asylum and the Playhouse. Please welcome Professor Pascal Drouet.
This talk is entitled, or this lecture is entitled, Madness in Jacobean England, The Asylum and the Playhouse. In this talk, I'd like to examine how, on the one hand, governors of the London Asylum of Bedlam, institutionally dealt with madness. That is, in fact, they were more interested in exploiting and exhibiting madmen for lucrative purposes, turning them into entertaining commodities than in curing them, not to mention understanding madness itself. I would like to examine how, on the other hand, how playwrights and stage directors had scenes of asylum performed on stage. That is, they exploited, of course, the spectacular potential of madness with actors who counterfeited madmen. But more importantly, they provided spectators with their own critical glance, holding a harsh mirror to the asylum and its mismanagement. But before focusing on the asylum and the playhouse, two places whose practices created unexpected mirror effects, it is necessary to briefly go back to the Middle Ages, when, instead of being locked up in asylums, madmen were put on ships of fools, a radically different way of dealing with madness. So, in those days, it was not necessary to buy a ticket if you wanted to be confronted with madness. So, this is what I'll study in the first part. As you see, it's a typically French outline divided into three parts. So we'll start with the medieval heritage, the natural fool, and the ship of fools. In the Middle Ages, the insane was called a natural fool, natural because they considered that he was born a fool, that is, he was part of the common landscape of everyday life. He could talk freely, go through villages, and stay as long as he wanted in one place. The simpleton, or natural fool, as Walter Kaiser recaps in his book Praises of Folly, Erasmus, Rabelais, and Shakespeare, was accepted basically for three reasons. I'm quoting it. For the stupidity of his words and deeds, he was often derided. For his inability to behave and understand like other people, he was sometimes pitied. And occasionally, because he was thought to be under the special protection of God, he was venerated. For all three reasons, he was tolerated. The natural fool was called so, a natural fool, because he was maladjusted to the world from his very birth. He was foolish by nature. That is, his madness was not some strategic counterfeiting, as is the case, as you know, with Hamlet in Shakespeare's tragedy. Nor was it a professional choice, as is the case for king's fools, who are not natural but artificial fools, as King Lear's fool. So the natural fool is a child of nature, and consequently, and I'm still quoting from Kaiser, he is unconscious of the rules of propriety. He says and does whatever is natural for him to say or do at any given moment. So, the natural fool could speak freely and behave as he wanted to. He was granted impunity, and this is important. This was also due to the belief that God might speak through him. As Kaiser observes, and this is the second quote, it was always possible that when the fool's babbling was not idiotic, it was theopneustic, that is, theogod and breath. That is, once again, he was all licensed. We understand why Jacobean playwrights would later have an interest in creating such characters on stage. Their fictitious madmen could be innocently irreverent and be used as subversive elements to criticize and question social, political, and religious issues, while themselves, the playwrights, remained immune from censorship. In the Middle Ages, when normal people turned stark mad, and when natural fools turned aggressive and dangerous, they would be embarked onto what was called the Ship of Fools. There are many engravings and paintings of the Ship of Fools. Among the most famous one is Hieronymus Bosch's painting. You have a preliminary sketch there, the Ship of Fools, and of course the most famous painting now at the Louvre Museum, dating back to 1500, is this one. I'm sure you've seen this painting before. Now, this painting is supposed to be a pictorial interpretation of Sebastian Brandt's book, Narrenschiff, of Ship of Fool, which he wrote in German language in 1484, and this was translated in English in 1509. A book that had engravings showing ships loaded with fools drifting towards the paradise of fools called Narragonia. And this was enriched with woodcuts by Albrecht Dürer. Now, of course, in France, we have Foucault. So let's see what Foucault had to say about this. Foucault's hypothesis is that those ships of fools haunted people's imagination in early modern times, an obsession that was visible on paintings and engravings. Why? First, because of their symbolic dimension. On board, fools were like symbolic pilgrims traveling in quest of reason. Two, also because the ship of fools evoked a practice that was grounded in reality. That is, the insane were embarked upon the ship of fools and became perpetual wanderers, external exiles. Bargemen would sail them from one town to the next. Now, Foucault in Madness and Civilization, A History of Insanity in the Age of Reason, remarkably analyzed the implications, both real and symbolic, of such a practice. So I'm going to quote Foucault. It's a bit long, but I think it's really an interesting analysis. So he wrote, and I thought you'd be happy to have the English translation and not the French. So he wrote, on the one hand, we must not minimize its incontestable practical effectiveness. To hand a madman over to sailors was to be permanently sure he would not be prowling beneath the city walls. It made sure that he would go far away. It made him a prisoner of his own departure. But water adds to this the dark mass of its own values. It carries off, but it does more, it purifies. Navigation delivers man to the uncertainty of fate. On water, each of us is in the hands of his own destiny. Every embarkation is potentially the last. It is for the other world that the madman sets sail in his fool's boat. It is from the other world that he comes when he disembarks. The madman's voyage is at once a rigorous division and an absolute passage. In one sense, it simply develops across a half-real, half-imaginary geography, and I think it's interesting that we have half-real, half-imaginary, the madman's liminal position on the horizon of medieval concern, a position symbolized and made real at the same time by the madman's privilege of being confined within the city gates. His exclusion must paradoxically enclose him. If he cannot and must not have another prison than the threshold itself, he is kept at the point of passage. And he goes on, and what I like here is the symbolic elements he points out. And of course, that's the symbolic elements we lost when we moved on to the great confinement in early modern time. Water and navigation certainly play this role. Confined on the ship, there is no escape. The madman is delivered to the river with its thousand arms, the sea with its thousand roads, to that great uncertainty external to everything. He is a prisoner in the midst of what is the freest, the openest of routes. Bound fast at the infinite crossroads, he is the passenger par excellence. Okay, and I can stop here for this one. So before asylums, madhouses were created, fools would paradoxically be confined on the ships of fools that symbolized both geographical and mental wandering. They were confined in the open air and consequently still visible, not concealed from the citizens' sight. In early modern England, people became more and more obsessed with madness. They no longer tolerated madness, but felt threatened by it. And why did they feel threatened by it? Because they could not understand what it was and where it came from. And what is more, madness was more and more associated with death. To take up Foucault's phrase, I think this phrase is very telling. The head will become a skull is already empty. Madness is the déjà-là of death. La tête est vide, qui deviendra le crâne. La folie, c'est le déjà-là de la mort. And if you have a look at Shakespeare's plays, you will see how this phrase is illustrated with his characters. People in early modern England obsessively remembered the medieval ship of fools, and this might be connected with a major social change that happened then. The wandering ship of fools was replaced with asylums and houses of correction. As Foucault puts it, confinement has succeeded embarkation. L'internement fait suite à l'embarquement. So the early modern period initiated the times of what he called the Great Confinement, which leads me to the second part, Foucault's Great Confinement, Bethlehem Hospital, known as Bedlam Asylum. Now, originally, and you can see what it looked like on the slide, originally Bedlam was a priory established in 1247 for the Bishop of St. Mary of Bethlehem, hence its name. It was converted into a hospital for lunatics. It was converted into the Hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem, and then it became more specifically the first hospital for lunatics in 1402. Now, things changed with the Reformation. King Henry VIII ordered all the monasteries to be closed, and in 1530, so that break with Rome, 1533. In 1536, George Boleyn, that is Anne Boleyn's brother, who was the governor of the hospital, was just beheaded, and the lunatics were expelled from Bedlam. 2 years later, 1538, the mayor of London petitioned the king to regard favorably the religious houses that had been founded, quote, only for the relief and comfort of poor and impotent people unable to help themselves, end of quote. It took no less than 8 years for Henry VIII to say yes just before he died in 1546. He granted Bethlehem the city of London, provided the city would pay for the maintenance and restoration work. But the city had no money. In 1557, the asylum was placed under the management of Bridewell, the London House of Correction, whose bad reputation would also be firmly established. So, to make a long story short, funding priority never seems to have been given to Bethlehem or Bedlam. As Donoghue puts it, he's the historian of Bedlam, as he puts it with a very telling metaphor, quote, Bethlehem has always been the Cinderella among her disdainful sister hospitals, end of quote. So instead of being boarded on ships of fools, madmen were imprisoned in an institution that was more like a prison than an asylum, and a prison that was badly tended at that. So the question is, how lunatics were dealt with in early modern England? Well, we have a first answer from Salgado, who wrote a book entitled The Elizabethan Underworld. And in this book, he writes, quote, the treatment of the lunatics in the 16th century was as brutal as it was ineffective. Society was not prepared to put up with a poor man who was insane, and so he was treated in much the same way as witches, whores, vagrants, and others whose conduct was likely to be socially nonconformist. All that a pauper lunatic could expect was regular beating. Confinement in a dark room, undergone by Malvolio in Twelfth Night, was one of the more civilized remedies prescribed for those whose wits were afflicted, end of quote. As Foucault remarked, madness was less than ever linked to medicine, nor could it be linked to the domain of correction. Unchained animality could be mastered only by discipline and brutalizing. La folie relève moins que jamais de la médecine. Elle ne peut pas appartenir davantage au domaine de la correction. Animalité déchaînée, on ne peut la maîtriser que par le dressage et l'abêtissement. Lunatics had no beds. They slept on straw. They couldn't benefit from any hygiene. They were called, like Shakespeare's character in King Lear, Tom of Bedlam, and they had to daily leave the asylum to beg for food because the asylum had no money to properly feed them. Not only were they not cured, but the absence of proper food fueled their mental disease. This was analyzed by Italian Piero Camporesi in his book translated in English, Bread of Dreams, Food and Fantasy in Early Modern Europe. It's a very interesting book, and this is just a short quotation taken from it. He writes, "The most effective and upsetting drug, bitterest and most ferocious, has always been hunger, creator of unfathomable disturbances of mind and imagination. Further lifelike and convincing dreams grew out of this forced hallucination, compensating for the everyday poverty," end of quote. So madness was only disciplined and aggravated. As Donald Lupton noted in 1622 when he visited the asylum, quote, "It seems strange that anyone should recover here. The cryings, screechings, roarings, brawlings, shaking of chains, swearings, threatings, chaffings are so many, so hideous, so great," end of quote. What is even more shocking is that madmen were exploited as entertaining commodities. The asylum opened its doors to spectators who paid to see the spectacle of the insane. As William C. Carroll puts it in his book Fat King, Lean Beggar, Representations of Poverty in the Age of Shakespeare. Here it goes. "The bedlam poor are just another form of popular entertainment, culturally equivalent to various urban curiosities or to such theatricalized spectacles as bear baiting or stage plays," end of quote. And Salgado adds, "Both the harmless and the violent were available for important visitors to amuse themselves with." Amazing, isn't it? The general public had to pay for admission. The entertainment regularly provided included the beating of the inmates with wire whips and the opportunity to harass those who were chained from a safe distance, end of quote. The scandalous administration of Bedlam, its mismanagement, the pathetic state in which the lunatics were left, and their lucrative exploitation, all this was denounced and exposed in James I's reign, especially thanks to playwrights who introduced in their plays scenes depicting a visitation to some asylum that mirrored infamous Bedlam, which leads me to the final part entitled Bedlam in the Playhouse, a mirror up to infamous practices. Translating, appropriating the asylum of Bedlam and its Bedlamites on stage was current practice in Jacobean England, and it was even a fashionable trend. Why is that? There are several reasons. One, playwrights could create dramatic, spectacular effects with actors voicing nonsensical comic speeches and displaying unexpected, extravagant behaviors, so very theatrical. Second reason, while playwrights were entertaining their spectators, they could also denounce the way lunatics they're dealt with in madhouses, that is, whipped, beaten, infantilized, exploited, and of course not cured. A third reason could be that playwrights could satirize the bad running of Bedlam, the scandalous mismanagement of the madhouse. Jacobean playwrights seem to have been fascinated by the issue of madness. As Robert Rantoul Reid notes, there were, and I love the adverb abnormally, there was, quote, "an abnormally extensive use of madness upon the Jacobean stage," end of quote. if both Ophelia and Hamlet immediately cross our minds, Shakespeare's contemporary playwrights take the lion's share as regards the dramatic appropriations of another stage, that of Bedlam Asylum. Let's mention, for example, Thomas Dekker's The Honest Whore, Part 1, 1604, John Webster's The Duchess of Malfi, 1614, John Fletcher's The Pilgrim, 1621, and Thomas Middleton and William Rowley's The Changeling, 1622. In contrast with Hamlet and King Lear, these plays do not explore individual characters' disturbed psyche, maybe with the exception of Ferdinand in The Duchess of Malfi, but rather they question the way madmen are socially, that is to say, institutionally, dealt with. The treatment of lunatics in the 16th century was known to be brutal and ineffective. People were not prepared to put up with insanity. As William C. Carroll observes, quote, once they were inscribed in the discourse of poverty, the London mad could be classified as a social rather than a psychological problem, and official management could turn from the untreatable mind diseased. So they just pretended that they were not mad people, but socially displaced. How was this critically mirrored on the Jacobean stage? Let's take a couple of examples from the three plays, The Honest Whore, Part 1, The Changeling, and The Duchess of Malfi. And I'd like to begin with The Honest Whore, 1604. Of course, the plot is not located in London. The plot is located in Italy, Milan. But it's not difficult to tell that the Italian asylum holds a mirror up to the London madhouse. As the director of the asylum opens the doors to his visitors, he introduces two categories of lunatics. On the one hand, the innocuous fools, the simpletons, who are described as being tamed, a very piteous sight. And on the other hand, he presents the ferocious madmen associated with animals. So we come across there compared with hungry lions, or at one point they are said to be fierce as wild bulls and tameable as flies. It comes as no surprise that animal metaphors and comparisons should be used to depict ferocious madmen. And here again, we need to go back to Foucault's analysis. He writes, quote, there was a certain image of animality that haunted the hospitals of the period. Madness borrowed its face from the mask of the beast. Those chained to the cell walls were no longer men whose mind had wandered, but beasts preyed upon by natural frenzy. As if madness managed to rejoin, by a paroxysm of strength, the immediate violence of animality. This model of animality prevailed in the asylums and gave them their cage-like aspect, their look of the menagerie. Now, of course, we are curious to know how visitors responded. So how do visitors react in Thomas Dekker's play, The Honest Whore? The first category of inmates, the innocuous fools, triggers the visitor's pity. The second one, the wild animals, leaves them speechless. But some visitors happen to laugh. Now, when visitors laugh, they are immediately rebuked by not so mad a madman, who tells them, do you laugh at God's creature? Do you mock old age, you rogues? Is this grey beard and head counterfeit that you cry ha ha ha? The interesting word here, of course, is counterfeit, as it clearly refers to the dramatic sphere. The art of counterfeit. So, what is implicit in this quotation, in what this madman says, is that the art of counterfeiting belongs to the playhouse, not to the asylum, and so do visitors. If visitors want to be entertained and have fun, the proper place where they should go to is the playhouse, where actors were termed in those days a daily counterfeit. Now, let me move on to my second example, The Changeling by Middleton and Rowley. In this play, Dr. Alibius opens the doors of his private asylum to visitors, that is what he calls, I'm quoting from the play, the daily visitants that come to see my brain sick patients, end of quote. Well, this doctor, in fact, is a comic character. He's a caricature of a doctor. Not only is he a bad doctor, but what is more, he's a jealous husband, and he keeps his wife locked at home for fear she should have an affair with someone else. And the only entertainment she's allowed to have is to visit her husband's asylum. So she's absolutely ironical when she tells him, I'm quoting from the play, afford me then the pleasure of your bedlam. You were commending once today to me your last lunatic, what a proper body that was without brains to guide it, and what a pitiful delight appeared in that defect, as if your wisdom had found a mirth in madness. Pray, sir, let me partake if there be such a pleasure. End of quote. Her irony shows through her use of oxymorons, the putting together of terms that have opposite meanings, the pleasure of your bedlam, a pitiful delight, and of course a mirth in madness. And it shows through her final if there be such a place, which is a rhetorical supposition. Once she's seen the fools and madmen, she confirms that there is no entertainment at all. Quote, alack, alack, it is too full of pity to be laughed at. End of quote. But Dr. Alibius disagrees and intends to make money out of his inmates. He orchestrates a grotesque dance of fools and madmen to entertain people at a wedding party. The insane are like dancing puppets, commodities, financially exploited by the doctor, who is satisfied and concludes, quote, we shall have coin and credits for our pains, end of quote. Now, this reads as a criticism of the managers of Bedlam, who are more interested in making money out of the lunatics than in seeing to their welfare. The target of the satire, as you understand, is not madness, but the inhuman treatment of it for lucrative purposes. I'm now moving to the third and final example taken from The Duchess of Malfi. In a more vicious way, yes, this is possible. In a more vicious way that is exposed by playwrights, lunatics could be exploited not only as entertaining commodities, but also as instruments of torture. This is what Webster presents. This is what Webster presents us with in his tragedy of Blood, The Duchess of Malfi. Again, the plot is not located in London, but in Italy. This is very convenient to bypass censorship. The Duchess of Malfi. The Duchess is a widow, is a young widow, but her two brothers forbid her to marry again. So the Duchess gets married in secret to her Loban steward and has three children by him. To punish her and bring her to despair, the brothers have spies, so they discover the truth. To punish her and bring her to despair, her brother Ferdinand imprisons her and tortures her with the howling presence of madmen taken from the asylum. He wants to drive her mad. Quote, this is Ferdinand speaking. And cause she'll needs be mad, I'm resolved to remove forth the common hospital all the mad folks and place them near her lodgings. There, let them practice together, sing and dance and act their gambols to the full of the moon. So the Duchess is forced to hear the horribly discordant song of the madmen, and that and this song sounds like a dirge. I'm not going to sing here, though I could, but this is just to give you an idea of what the song is like. Well, in fact, the song makes sense, but you'll see what is interesting in the lyrics. Oh, Let us howl some heavy note, some deadly dogged howl, sounding as from the threatening throat of beast and fatal fowl, as a raven, screech owls, bulls and bears will bill and bawl our parts, till irksome noise have cloyed your ears and corrosived your hearts. So we see that if we have Foucault's analysis in mind, there are many, many references to animals and beasts. And of course, they play with alliterations and weird sounds in the lines. But the Duchess is strangled by her brother's henchmen even before she has a chance to be contaminated and turn mad herself. So Webster's tragedy shows how madmen are perversely exploited and ironically turned into torture. If you want to know more about this play, The Duchess of Malfi, which is a great tragedy, please feel free to have a look at the book, at the collection of essays that William C. Carroll mentioned earlier and which we co-edited a year ago. So, To conclude, in early modern England, two practices were common and fashionable, especially in London: visiting the madhouse of Bedlam and theatre going to hear a play, including scenes of visitation to some asylum. Thus, citizens could watch real madmen in the asylum and counterfeit madmen in the playhouse. They could compare the thing itself, as Lear puts it, and its onstage representation. They could experience shocking confrontation in the asylum and critical detachment in the playhouse. Madmen were confined, but they were daily visited and they were daily impersonated on stage, which triggered an awareness that was both emotional and reflexive. And I think this is interesting between the madhouse and the playhouse. You have the two dimensions, emotion and reflection. What might have been the purpose of playwrights such as Webster, Dekker, Middleton and Rowley? As I've said, to criticize the mismanagement of Bedlam Asylum and the exploitation of its inmates. This is the first answer. Second answer, probably to awaken their spectators' consciousness to the diversity and complexity of human nature. Third and last, to suggest that madness, in spite of its senseless microsyntax, that is, the incoherent speeches of lunatics, to suggest that madness, in spite of its senseless microsyntax, is to be part of society's macro syntax. That is, we have no social state, no social organization, no citizen can pretend that madness does not exist, that it is not part of the dark side of mankind, and as such, worth exploring. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I've been tasked with presenting a question and then moderating questions. So thank you for such a wonderfully concise and pointed history of the development from the Middle Ages into this period. And I was also struck by lots of things, by the idea of that madness is to some extent a performance, the way in which the theater is, mirrors the asylum. And I was particularly struck by your distinction with Shakespeare, that is, his plays don't take us into the asylum, but rather take us into the individual consciousness. So I might come back to that in a moment. But let me begin by I'll just ask two questions and then open it to anyone who has questions. Can you say a little bit about how the writers in the period understood the causes of madness? In other words, what were the various explanations? So, for example, we know with plague, there were multiple explanations, none of them the right one, because it was one of those phenomena that simply wasn't understood. And so what did you see in the way of explanations for why people are mad?
Mm. Of course, this is a thank you, Bill. This is a major question. I'm afraid I have no answer. You mentioned the plague. I think it was basically the same with madness, and this is why they were terrified with madness, because they had no convincing way of explaining madness. I think they connected madness with the theory of humors, mm-hmm. and said that, okay, if you're mad, it's because there is something that is unbalanced in so if you remember this theory, you have four humors, and a normal being has all the four balanced humors. So maybe there's something, there's too much color or too much melancholy. Or so I think they try to explain madness with the theory of humors. Probably they also had the idea that this could be genetic, for example, for the born fools. But did they have real explanations? Mm. I don't know. They also tended, and maybe this was later in the 17th century with Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, they also tended to connect madness and melancholy. In the plays I've commented upon very briefly, in fact, the playwrights don't seem to be interested. It's not like a detective story. They just present madness, and they want you to face madness, and what they want you to take into account, what they want you to become aware of, is that how badly madness is dealt with. But they have no other suggestion, and I don't think they question the origin of madness. And probably they don't question it because they don't know, and they suppose that we have no answer. Maybe with Webster we have an exception, because with the character of Ferdinand, so Ferdinand, it's very ironical because he's the one who wants to torture his sister with madmen taken from the asylum, but his punishment at the end of the tragedy is that he turns mad himself, and he falls prey to lycanthropy. And I think here, this is specific of Webster. He was interested in satirizing the institution, but also he tried to understand how madness would work its way through this character. So this character becomes mad at the end. He imagines himself transformed into a wolf. And in the play, we come to understand that this may be connected to the incestuous desire. To the incestuous desire he has for this sister, and of course a desire that he is repressed. So I'm making a long story short, but I think he does try to... So he has an interest in psychology, and he tries to understand the psychological motivations, disturbances that can account for madness. But maybe he's an exception.
I think I might add in one thing from earlier in your talk, one other possible cause, which is possession. So demonic possession
The
case of Edgar or Tom in King Lear, but also divine possession. And as you said, sometimes the idea was that the madman had been struck by God, so that whatever came out of his mouth was prophetic, but he didn't actually mean it. But these, of course, these are just their ideas at the time that they struggled to account for various phenomena that had to have a cause, but they simply didn't know what it was.
Yes, you're right. For example, the in King Lear, when Edgar impersonates poor Tom, he puts on a show, and of course he refers to those madmen who were possessed by the devil, and says he has hallucination, thinking that he's full of devils and pursued by the devils, by devils himself. Right. So thank you, Bill. I had forgotten about that.
Well, I'll turn to the audience. Will.
Sorry, yes. I have a lot of questions. Sorry, I have a lot of questions, but my first one is sort of piggyback on this. I guess The first question is just I've been sitting here trying to remember the details of the Malvolio scene, because, of course, that's what I know best here that I'm thinking of. Is there anything said to Malvolio, and question for both of you, really, that suggests there's an interest in curing him? And if so, how? Because it gets back to the question of the etiology, right? If you think you know what to do with a madman, then you must have a theory of how he came to be mad. And I mean, of course, there's a lot else going on with the Malvolio scene. Like, he's not crazy and so on. But I just wondered whether you remember anything of, I mean, is there a cure?
May I answer first?
Please. Okay. Yes.
And then you'll move on. Yes, thank you. It's an interesting point. Yes, I think that the punishment is that he's confined in a dark room. And here, to go back to your former question, I think the idea is that, well, of course, Malvolio is not mad. He's just a Puritan. He's a boor. He's a Puritan. And Maria and Sir Tobias want to punish him and make fun of him. But I think also the fake madness here is tightly connected to the idea of hubris, overweening pride, because the problem with Malvolio is that he's not getting mad, but he's just a steward, and at one point he's imagining that his mistress, Countess Olivia, is in love with him. So he turns very full of himself, and this the other characters can't bear. So I think we have this implicit connection between, this is a comedy, but we have the same idea, I think, in Macbeth, on the tragic side. We have an implicit connection between hubris, overweening pride, a character who could epitomize the figure of the overreacher, the one who wants to be more than a man himself. And this is dangerous because you can turn mad if you try to be an overreacher. So I think this is dealt on the comic mode with Malvolio.
Thank you.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I'm Jim Mifflin. I'm in Romance Studies, and I teach Spanish literature, and among other works that I teach is Don Quixote, who was perhaps the madman par excellence. But and I've written quite a bit on the phenomenon of madness in Don Quixote, and it's been a while. But I remember, of course, like everybody else, I was very much under the sway of Foucault. And then on the whole issue of the Ship of Fools, Foucault has been critiqued by a bunch of people, and apparently there's a bit of a debate about whether that practice of putting mad people on ships actually occurred, and whether it was perhaps Foucault's. And I was quite disappointed because I like the idea of them being on the ships, but he did too. But apparently there's not that much of a historical record of that. So that's just a pedantic point. On the whole issue of the representation of the asylums, by the way, there were a lot of asylums in Spain, and there are representations of mad people in Spanish theater, which I'd be happy to tell you about. But the big question I had as I was listening to your analysis is that you were assuming that these playwrights necessarily were critiquing the practices of Bedlam, and the question is how much of a projection of our modern sensibilities may be in play here, because when one reads about sensibilities of the period, I mean, you know, the politically correct was not there. I mean, there was honest, I mean, not honest, what am I saying? There was genuine enjoyment by tons of people of these spectacles. And I perhaps missed the part of your presentation that showed exactly where the criticism was coming in here. In other words, we like to assume that great writers are nice people and they are us.
Yeah.
And but and I was just missing that little link. In other words, what was the critique?
Yes, I've got your point. Thank you. Yes, of course, you're right. But when you work on, when you're a scholar and you work on centuries that are far behind, of course, you see them from your own point of view and from your 21st century. So of course, you're right. We have to be very careful. We're not projecting things. But we can't help projecting our own sensibilities onto what we're doing. I think this is not contradictory. Spectators could be entertained by, as you said about the Moor, could be entertained by horrible sights or weird spectacles. But I think this went together with the awareness of the playwright, and how do we know that? Well, if you read the plays, it's very clear that there is a satirical target. So I think, I don't know, we should go back to the text, but to me, there's no question that they put the blame on the way madmen were dealt with in these institutions. And also, we have historical evidence of how poorly Bedlam was tended and how it was mismanaged. And so I think we had this kind of fascination, as you said earlier, but at the same time, yes, I think they did want their spectators to realize that there is something wrong here.
Well, I think we've made our speaker work very hard. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Pascal Drouet, professor of English and Early Modern Literature at the University of Poitiers, France. Professor Drouet's lecture was titled Madness in Jacobean England, the Asylum and the Playhouse, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, the Center for the Study of Europe, and the Department of English. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of English William Carroll. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.